Who is the Lord? Who is Jesus? How do we approach him? How do we approach the Lord? What are the expectations that we have of the Lord? Do we expect him to make our life better, easier? When we talk to the Lord, do we seek earthly carnal benefits more than we seek character changes? More than we ask him to help us to be more like him? Do we seek rewards and resist renewal? Lord, give me this. Lord, do this for me. Lord, give me that. Do we view Jesus as little more than our secretary, our genie in the bottle? Do we see the Lord of all creation as little more than our PA, our divine personal assistant? In the field of astronomy and in the context of the earth and the sun, the word orbit is used to describe the elliptical orbit or the oval path of the earth around the sun, which takes a year, a little more than 365 days. I mentioned that it's an oval path, an elliptical orbit, to point out that depending on where the earth is located in its orbit, its path around the sun, the distance from the earth to the sun varies. Perihelion and aphelion are astronomical terms that are used to designate the closest and the farthest distances from a planetary body to the sun. Perihelion is the point in the orbit or the path where the earth is closest to the sun, and aphelion is the point in the orbit where the earth is farthest from the sun. In January, when the earth is at perihelion, it is 91,400,000 miles away from the sun. In July, when the earth is at aphelion, the earth is 94,500,000 miles away from the sun. Over the period of a year, the average distance from the earth to the sun is 92,955,807 miles, or round that off, it's 93 million miles from the earth to the sun. It would take only 8 minutes and 20 seconds to get there if you could travel at the speed of light, which is about 186,282 miles per second, which is over 670 million miles per hour. It would take a jumbo jet, which averages 555 miles an hour. It would take a jumbo jet 19 years to fly from the earth to the sun, but those are not 8-hour days. I calculated it out. That's maintaining that speed 24 hours a day, 365 days a year for 19 years. And so if you drove a car at 55 miles an hour, I'm going somewhere with this. Make that, 190 years, 190 years at 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. That's how far away the sun is. I wanted to impress you with how far it is to the sun so I could then impress you with how tiny that distance is compared to the entire universe. I've said all that to say this. If the distance between the earth and the sun was the thickness of a piece of paper, I'll stop and let that sink in for a moment. If the 93 million miles distance from the earth to the sun was the thickness of a piece of paper, then the diameter of our galaxy, the distance from one side of the galaxy to the other, would be a stack of papers 310 miles high. And our galaxy is a speck of dust in the part of the universe that we can see. And that part of the universe might just be a speck of dust compared to all the universe. And I'll give that a moment. Now, if Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and if Jesus Christ is the one who holds all this together with the power of his word, is this the kind of person that you can ask in your life to be your personal assistant? When the book of Exodus opens, the Israelites have been living in Egypt for several hundred years. Chapter 1 of Exodus describes how the Israelites became slaves in that land. Chapter 2 tells us about Moses' birth and how at the age of 40 he fled from Egypt because there was a price on his head. Next few chapters tell about the Lord speaking to Moses 40 years later when Moses is 80 years old. And God tells him to go back to Egypt. God tells him to confront the Pharaoh. Moses approaches Pharaoh with the request to let God's people go, release the children of Israel, set the Israelites free. The Egyptians believed that the Pharaohs were gods, or it would be more appropriate to say they believed the Pharaohs were demigods. A demigod is a being with partial divine status, a mortal who is the offspring of God, or of some god. We might say that it was a half god, half man, is the idea. The ancient Egyptian pharaohs served as mediators between their people and the gods. Interestingly enough, the word pharaoh is actually a Greek word that's based on an Egyptian word that means great house, as in the palace. When this word was first used, it referred to the palace of the king and its greatness. It did not refer to just the king himself. Might ask why they would call their king a word which referred to the palace where he lived. I understand that it was done so out of respect, out of deference, if you will. They referred to the king indirectly because they thought it was disrespectful to speak about the king directly, about a God king in such a way. So they used that title that referred to the palace instead, kind of like saying, we're talking about the man who lives in the big house. I want us to see how this man was viewed, how he viewed himself and how he was viewed by others. I want us to understand that what this man, the Pharaoh, the incarnation of the god Horus, Pharaoh the son of Ra, I want us to understand what Pharaoh thought about himself. When we understand this, it helps us to better appreciate this Pharaoh's response to Moses when Moses made this request of him. Reading from Exodus chapter 4, verses 29 through chapter 5 and verse 9. Exodus 4, 29 beginning, Moses and Aaron brought together all the elders of the Israelites, and Aaron told them everything the Lord had said to Moses. He also performed the signs before the people, and they believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and worshiped. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, let my people go so that they may hold a festival to me in the wilderness." Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." Then they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Now let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God, or he may strike us with plagues or with the sword. But the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, said, "Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their labor? Get back to your work." Then Pharaoh said, "Look, the people of the land are now numerous, and you are stopping them from working." That same day, Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and overseers in charge of the people. He said, "You are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Let them go and gather their own straw, but require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They are lazy. That is why they are crying out, saying, 'Let us go and sacrifice to our God.' Make the work harder for the people so that they keep working and pay no attention to lies." Again, verse 2 tells us, Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." A few chapters later, we read of the first of the 10 plagues that the Lord brought up on the land of Egypt. First plague was when the waters of the Nile River were turned to blood. Second plague was a plague of frogs. The third was a plague of lice and then flies, followed by disease on their livestock. Next came boils, then hail, and after that came a plague of locusts. The ninth plague was darkness over the entire country. Finally, the 10th plague was the death of all the firstborn children in Egypt, including the firstborn of all their livestock. Each one of these plagues was an attack upon one or more of the gods of Egypt. Each plague showed that Yahweh, that Jehovah, that God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, was the only true and living God. Each plague showed that the gods of the Egyptians were mere figments of men's imaginations. These gods had no power. They were weak. They were powerless inventions of mortal men. The arrogance, the stubbornness, the willful blindness of Pharaoh is seen again and again as he resists the powerful hand of God, as he opposes the mighty God of all creation who is destroying him and his own nation. Though it's not repeated, Pharaoh's question, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?" echoes again and again as he refuses to submit to the Lord. He saw Jehovah as inferior to him. He saw Yahweh as one beneath him. He saw the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as one who simply he did not need to listen to. And at any point during those 10 plagues, a fair question to ask Pharaoh would have been, "How's that working out for you?" We see this same attitude on display again and again throughout Scripture. For example, as the Israelites and others obstinately reject God's warnings and continually refuse to obey him, they embody the words of Pharaoh in their attitudes and their behaviors as they metaphorically repeat the question, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?" We see Israel in the wilderness repeatedly murmuring and complaining. We see them rising up in rebellion. We see them displaying ingratitude for the blessings of God. Why isn't God taking better care of us? Why did he bring us out here in this wilderness to die? Why is he letting this happen to us? Instead of viewing themselves as God's servants, instead of seeing themselves as mere dust, people who were privileged above all people on the earth, that God had selected them, like Pharaoh, they were viewing God as beneath them. They were looking at the God of the universe as their divine personal assistant. We could trace that same attitude of rebellion, obstinance, and arrogance throughout the 300-year period of the judges once they entered the promised land. We could see it in the 400 years of history during the united and divided kingdoms, as many of the kings and the people of Israel asked the same question, in essence, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?" We watch over and over again as God's people resist the teachings, the instructions, the warnings of the Lord's prophets. Perhaps one of the most illustrative examples of such arrogant rebellion was King Jehoiakim of Judah. Just over 100 years before Jehoiakim's reign, the northern kingdom of Israel had been carried off as captives by the nation of Assyria. They'd suffered such a fate because of their idolatry, because of their worship of false gods, their refusal to listen to the warnings of the prophets God had sent to them. And so God allowed the Assyrian nation to destroy them because of their persistent rebellion against the Lord. King Jehoiakim should have remembered that lesson. Jehoiakim reigned over the nation of Judah a few years before 600 BC. At that time, the southern kingdom of Judah was only 2 decades away from suffering the same fate as her northern sister Israel had already suffered. The prophet Jeremiah was being persecuted for speaking the truth, for warning God's people that they were going to be punished, for warning that the city of Jerusalem and that the entire nation of Judah was going to face God's judgment if they didn't repent, if they didn't stop their wickedness. In Jeremiah chapter 36 and verse 4, Jeremiah dictated the words of the Lord to his scribe named Baruch. Then Jeremiah instructed Baruch to take the scroll, to read it in the hearing of all the people. And when a man named Micaiah heard the reading of the scroll, he went down to the king's house and he declared all the words that he'd heard. He reiterated those words to all the princes who were sitting in an inner chamber of the king's house, King Jehoiakim's house. After hearing Micaiah summarize what he himself had heard, all the princes sent for Baruch and had him read the scroll to them. And so we pick up in verse 16 of that chapter and read through verse 23. Jeremiah 36, 16 through 23 says, "When they heard all these words, they looked at each other in fear and said to Baruch, 'We must report all these words to the king.' Then they asked Baruch, 'Tell us, how did you come to write all this? Did Jeremiah dictate it?' 'Yes,' Baruch replied, 'he dictated all these words to me, and I wrote them in ink on the scroll.' Then the official said to Baruch, 'You and Jeremiah go and hide. Don't let anyone know where you are.' After they put the scroll in the room of Elishama, the secretary, they went to the king in the courtyard and reported everything to him. The king sent Jehudi to get the scroll, and he brought it from the room of Elishama, the secretary, and read it to the king and all the officials standing beside him. It was the ninth month, and the king was sitting in the winter apartment with the fire burning and the fire pot in front of him. Whenever this man had read three or four columns of the scroll, the king cut them off with a scribe's knife and threw them into the fire pot until the entire scroll was burned in the fire. By his actions, by his behavior, by his arrogant defiance, King Jehoiakim had asked the question, 'Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?' And we want to ask all these people again and again, how is that working out for you? Within 3 months, King Jehoiakim's son was deported to Babylon. And within 20 years, the whole nation of Judah had been destroyed. The city of Jerusalem was plundered, and many of the people were carried off as captives to Babylon. When we come to the New Testament, perhaps the parable of the prodigal son represents all who turn away from God, saying, in essence, 'Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?' The word prodigal means wasteful. The prodigal son is a story about a young man who squandered all his blessings. It's a parable about a young man who rejected the wisdom and the guidance of his father in order to pursue his own desires. He lived his life in reckless abandon, following, pursuing whatever his heart desired, living for the moment. Perhaps the prodigal son serves as the epitome, the perfect example of all who accept and gladly receive the blessings that God gives to all people, and then refuses to acknowledge God's right to rule in their lives, refuses to accept any of the responsibilities or to give any of the glory to God. This young man was asking, 'Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?' But the parable doesn't end that way. Parable tells about the young man recognizing what a mess he'd made of his life, and it tells of him coming to his senses. Luke 15, verses 11 through 23, parable says, beginning in verse 11, Jesus said, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. So he got up and he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? Jesus' disciples got a glimpse of that answer, and that particular answer to that question in Matthew 8, 23 through 27. We looked at Mark's account of this last week. Matthew 8, verses 23 through 27. The text says, Then he got into the boat and his disciples followed him. Suddenly a furious storm came upon the lake so that the waves swept over the boat. But Jesus was sleeping. The disciples went and woke him, saying, Lord, save us, we are going to drown. He replied, You of little faith, why are you so afraid? Then he got up and rebuked the winds and the waves, and it was completely calm. The men were amazed and asked, Who can this be that even the winds and the waves obey him? Several months later, we read from Matthew 14, verses 22 through 33. The text says, Immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side of the sea while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. Later that night, he was there alone, and the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them walking on the water. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. It's a ghost, they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, Take courage, it is I. Don't be afraid. Lord, if it's you, Peter replied, tell me to come to you on the water. Come, Jesus said. And Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and began sinking. He cried out, Lord, save me. Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. You of little faith, he said, why did you doubt? And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, Truly you are the Son of God. On that first occasion, they wondered about his identity. On the second occasion, they made a powerful proclamation. But time would reveal that they still did not fully grasp, or they failed to accept who Jesus really was. Trying to wrestle this out in their minds, struggling with it, trying to get a hold of the concept. A few months later in Matthew 17, verses 1 through 6, we read, After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up on a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. But while he was still speaking, a bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him. When the disciples heard this, they fell face down on the ground, terrified. In Jesus' day, there were lots of ideas about who he was. On different occasions, it was expressed that some thought Jesus was John the Baptizer raised from the dead, or that he was Elijah or Jeremiah or one of the prophets. There are still lots of ideas about who Jesus is today. Some religious groups teach that Jesus was an angel or a god with a lowercase g. Some teach Jesus was just a prophet. Some insist that he was merely some guru, a sage, a wise man, another Buddha, if you will. Some insist Jesus was just a good moral teacher. C.S. Lewis once wrote, "You must make your choice. Either this man, Jesus, was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come up with any patronizing nonsense about him being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to." John chapter 1, verses 1 through 4 says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God." Down in verse 14 tells us the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, so this is talking about Jesus. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind." Matthew chapter 7, verse 21, Jesus said, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven." Luke 6, 46, Jesus said, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do the things I say?" Who is Jesus? Who is he to you? Who is he to me? Do you see Jesus as the Son of God? Do you see him as the one through whom all things were made? Do you see Jesus as the master of the ocean, the earth, and the skies? The master of the universe? The one you must believe in, the one you must submit to, the one you must obey? Or do you see Jesus as the one on whom you call to get the things you want? The one who should answer your prayers and respond to your needs? Do you see Jesus as little more than your divine personal assistant? If you recognize Jesus' divinity, if you recognize him as Lord and as God who came in the flesh, and if you believe that he has the right to rule you and to reign supreme in your life, and you know that you are without hope if he's not ruling your life, if you know these things, if you believe these things, then you're at the right place in your life. There's hope for anyone who recognizes those things. If you don't know what the Lord requires of you, I'll be glad to talk to you after we're dismissed. If you know what he does require of you, and if you're ready to make him Lord of your life, at this time we invite you to come forward and make that known while we stand together and sing.